If you want to see examples of what we talked about on the show, check out bunchofdorks.com and click on the Cyclops.
Hello, I'm Al Val, and you're listening to Two Dimension, the comic book podcast of No Direction. And sitting across from me is a man that speaks with very limited vocabulary and says the same thing over and over, is my friend, Don Moore.
Hi, I'm Don. How the hell are you out there in radio listener land? No, I'm not Don, I'm Al Val.
Yeah,
you're Don.
I'm Don, but you know Al, he lives his own life without rules, which is something that
I'm a rebel.
It amazes me. So I tried to live like Al, and I find that if I don't have a world perfectly constructed with laws, I don't live like Al does.
No.
I don't know how you pull it off because you seem like a good citizen. You have an orderly life, but you live it your own way.
OTG, man.
Mine was chaotic. It was,
OTG.
Those 3 weeks I spent in jail, no.
Oh, God, I don't want to talk about that. We couldn't do any podcasts. I tried to bring the laptop in there, but it didn't work out. All the other freaking prisoners were, like, yelling and screaming, and they wanted in on it. And I was like, no, not this show. Maybe when you get out, you can come over Brooke's house and we'll do a show there on like prison comics or something. I don't know.
That would happen if I didn't follow the rules. I see guys do it all the time. There was a friend of mine on the ship. In the Navy, there's nothing but rules because, it has to be.
Yeah.
But this friend of mine, he was a good sailor. But, man, he never did anything he was supposed to. And one time, We had to paint, and when you paint, it's a nightmare because you have to go down to the bosun's locker to get the thinner, the brushes. They control all of it because, it's a controlled substance. And after we were finished, we had to, go down and, clean the brushes. Well, the bosun's locker was closed for like 2 hours. I'm like, what? We couldn't get the thinner for it, and we had these, brushes, oil-based paint. We had to come back later. And I'm like, Billy just said, oh, blanket, I'm just going to throw them overboard. And then, the guys at the boat, I wouldn't advise that. And they get real aggressive to us. But we go back up on deck, and in front of everybody, Billy throws the brush over the side. And I'm like, I couldn't believe it. And then all of a sudden, these guys are yelling, hey, you can't do that. I'm getting my chief. And then the chief comes over. Grabs Billy and says, son, did you just throw a brush overboard? And Billy looked at him and goes, no. And the chief just looked dumbfounded. I mean, the whole time I'm standing there like Jerry Lewis, like, I can't believe he did that. He threw a brush over. I didn't say anything, but I'm just looking just like Don Knotts or something. And the chief was just dumbfounded, went back to his men who were wanting to, lynch us. And I said, Billy, how did you get away with that? Hey, it doesn't matter what you do as long as you act like you know what you're doing. And that was one of many things that he did.
Those are rules for life. It doesn't matter what you do as long as you come across as knowing what you're doing.
Well,
yeah.
It catches up with you at one point.
It does. You end up going to jail.
I guess sometimes even little things like that. They
or getting impeached or something. It catches up with you at some point. But for a while there, it's all good. It's like, hey, with me. I know what I'm doing.
You can get away with it for a while. I'm sounding like Porky Pig now.
Yeah, I can do that one.
But like I said, after a while it builds up and builds up. And then when they get you for one thing, they just tack all the rest on.
But
it would happen immediately. I wouldn't get away with anything.
Now, when you were on the ship, did the ship have a comic book spinner rack?
Yeah.
It did?
Yeah.
Serious?
Yeah.
That is awesome, okay?
Well,
I salute the Navy.
They had, I was trying to think how many stores. I guess they had about four stores.
They had newsstands or just like
no,
just general
it
stores?
Was, the main store everybody went to was the Gedunk, which was it was like a snack window, a concession stand. But, that's where you got anything.
Snacks.
Candy bars, peanuts. Well, sodas we had machines for.
Oh, okay.
Cookies, Slim Jims, all this stuff.
Oh, wow.
Then they had the Hawk Shop, which is basically they sold uniforms in it. If you know, watches, you know, they had those Zippo lighters with the ship's insignia, you know. A lot of stuff in there with ship's insignia, keychains, ball caps, all this stuff that you had to wear on the ship. I remember some of the Yardbirds would come into work. And,
like Jimmy Page or yeah. Jeff Beck?
No,
or...
they were civilian workers that worked
the band.
On the ship.
Okay, all right.
And this one guy came up to us, and he was Asian and had a really thick accent. And he asked me and my friend, he wanted us to go in the Hawk Shop and buy him a Zippo lighter. And we didn't understand what he said, so he wrote it down on paper. Okay, so we went and bought him a Zippo lighter. At the time, I thought, why would you want one of these? And but I guess he collected them. I guess every ship he worked on, he got a Zippo lighter from.
Oh, okay.
But, you know, it has the ship's logo on it and all that. As a matter of fact, saying that, I did get one. I still got it.
That's pretty neat.
Well, I bought one for my mom because she smokes. And I guess the Zippo lighters kind of went away and everybody's using those disposable Bic lighters and stuff.
Yeah.
And
so there was people on the ship that worked that were civilians when the ship sailed out to sea?
No. Once in a while you'd have some civilians, but they were specialists. They worked like technical, I think sonar and stuff like
but
that.
But I mean, even when the ship was out at sea, they would go and they would go with you guys?
We had about five of them.
Where would they live? Would they have their own room or would they live with?
They didn't live with us. I guess they probably had a ward room. I think they were treated like officers.
Wow.
They wore khakis like the officers and chiefs did, but they didn't have any military insignia.
They were tech guys.
Yeah. I mean, they didn't have any authority over us, you know, but, you know, they were, I guess everybody kind of looked at them as an officer, but they didn't issue orders and we didn't listen to them. But,
so when you went to the gift shop or whatever, they had a spinner rack of comics.
Oh, yeah. Well, that wasn't a gift shop. They had a toiletry store, which is actually a pretty crummy store, but that's where you could get your soap and toothpaste and, you know, junk like that. And they had magazines, and they always had Playboy, had Penthouse, and they might even had Hustler, which surprises me. But I know they always had Playboy and Penthouse.
Hey, we're going to have fun finding those images for the blog.
I'm not putting any of this up. They always had a Heavy Metal and National Lampoon, always.
Okay.
And they had a spinner rack with comic books, but every time I went in there, there'd be like 12 comic books. I mean, it wasn't much.
That's sad, huh?
And it was always picked through. It was always, you know, as a kid, when you used to go to the convenience store, before all the new comic books came out, how it was all picked through, and it was just the stuff nobody really wanted left. That was the Kitty Hawk spinner rack in the toiletry store.
Did you ever buy a book from there?
I bought an issue of Alpha Flight. I bought two of them. One issue of Alpha Flight, I think it had Wolverine on the cover.
Okay.
And John Byrne drew it, and I bought a couple. But they tore the toiletry store down. In my second cruise, they had a window, another concession stand, but it was really slick because the whole window was all plexiglass, and all the shelves, you could see the toiletries, mouthwash, all the stuff in it. And it was always well stocked, and then they had stacks of comic books. I bought Grew. They always had Grew.
Wow.
This has been epic with printing it, you know, for the
So it was new stuff. They wouldn't have like old things.
And they had stacks of them. I remember buying one of John Byrne's Fantastic Fours. I bought Grew, three or four months when it was coming out. But they had in other places too. Oh, and they also had the electronics shop, which is where you went to get cassette tapes. They always had a little, like the stores, they had the little case with the glass in the front, and you had to get the clerk to unlock it if you wanted one.
Right.
But he had you could get boom boxes and really crummy Walkmans and stuff like that there.
Now, when you went to, this is getting in a very nautical theme here, but when you went to, like, other countries, did you ever buy comic books from the countries, like an Australian comic
every
book
one
or
of
a Philippine? Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
Every one of them, but... Yeah, in the Philippines.
The Pinoy comics
in the
Philippines.
Yeah, comics with a K.
Comics, yeah, right.
I bought one that, I bought a couple. I couldn't read them. But even the newsprint was a real low-grade newsprint.
Yeah.
And the covers were printed on the same exact newsprint you know, it wasn't a slick cover like this. What I liked, the one issue I bought, it was kind of bizarre. It reminded me of those, when you used to go to the Midway at the state fairs and stuff, and you see the freak shows, and they'd have the they'd have those big drawings of the you know, subjects in the show.
Yeah.
And sometimes they have people with like claws instead of hands, and you know, bird people and stuff. That's what this I think it was a kid that was part crab, and then there was this goddess-looking woman head behind him. I'm gonna scan that and put it on the
blog. I have never had the pleasure of seeing that. Whenever we had, you know, like state fairs, it was just the usual rides and all that crap.
Well, when I was in high school, I started going with my parents. Me and my friend went to all those shows.
That is amazing. That's like the old world.
But they're
with the freaks and all that.
They're really disappointing.
Well,
I remember when I was a kid, we did one time. There was a skeleton of the Arabian giantess.
Oh, cool.
And the voice went, "The Arabian giantess. She amazed people from around the world. Come see." You know, and I mean, it was just a recording, but it was constantly going. And you just heard, "Arabian giantess," constantly on this loop. And they had a, you know, on the front of the place, it was all these drawings of this giant 12-foot, really beautiful woman dressed as an Arabian woman, except that she was half-dressed, but she had the veil in the front of her face, and all these sheiks were all standing around her just, like, amazed, because, you know, she was, like, twice their size. And I was 7 years old, and we were standing in line for it, and some of the people were saying, "It's not real, it's not real." And Mom said, "I don't care, I've got to see it anyway." And we went in there, and it was a skeleton, and but it had a massive head. You could tell somebody made it,
yeah.
You know, but I don't know. I kept saying, "Mom, why are we in here looking at this? Well, look how big she is." Well, it was big, but it wasn't proportioned. It wasn't like a body of a nice big person. It was, I don't know, you know.
It was disappointing to you, the 7-year old.
Well, no, I didn't really care. I went back to it later, and it did kind of creep me out, but even though knowing it was fake. But anyway, when I was in high school, we did go to all these shows, and a lot of them were just really bad magic tricks. Like, there was one girl that could turn into a snake, and they had this woman that was kind of like a sort of a bad belly dancer, you know, and she'd come out and, you know, do a couple of things. And the guy would be presenting her, and then she would go up and say, what was it? She'd go in this little tube, and then he'd do the, you know, the blades you shove down into the tube.
Oh, yeah,
know?
Yeah.
And he goes, "Oh, there she is. She's all coiled up down in the bottom as a snake." And you never saw her turn into a snake.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And when kids would try to get up on the stage and look over, and they were all jumping up, and he'd be like, "Get off the stage!" Just, you know, I mean, it was that bad. And, then they had farm animals in another Midway show.
That would be the state fair.
Yeah, it was.
I remember the farm animals.
Well, no, but this was still on the Midway for the what they call the freak shows.
Like a two-headed cow or something?
Yeah, well, they had a cow with five legs.
Oh.
And that was real.
Wow.
But the fifth leg was on his right shoulder hanging off, and it didn't move. It was
like just a baby leg there. Yeah.
And it was just stuff like that, you know, and some of it was pickled, you know.
Pickled creatures, you know. Yeah. Yeah, well. Yeah.
So it was nothing but disappointment. I just did that once when I was 14.
Oh, that's pretty funny.
But anyway, this Filipino cover, it was like that. And every time I bought one of these comics, the people on the street would come over and say, "Well, can you read Tagalog?" "No." "Why are you buying that?" "Well, because I wanted a Filipino comic." "Oh, okay." And then they start reading it to you, what it said on the cover. And I remember he saying, that little crab boy was saying something about, you know, "I don't know what to do." I'm, you know, and the goddess behind him was saying, "Don't worry, little one. We'll work this out." Mm. But what I really liked about it was the person that signed it. You know, he signed his name. You know how some artists will even sign their name and then write the date, you know, like the year or whatever. Well, this person, he signed his name, and then he wrote the date, and then he had the what was it, the month, the day of the week.
Wow.
And then it just all across the bottom, a little tiny writing, he was talking about all the way to the second, and I guess he was writing what he did. It was a, you know, It was great. It was funny, but it's like a lot of things that you probably miss if you weren't paying attention. I just thought.
You know, the thing is I can remember, like, nowadays, I don't even know if the cheapy bins, but I remember back in the 80s and even in the 90s, you'd go through the quarter bins or the cheapy bins. I remember sometimes they had dime bins, and every once in a while you'd find like a comic book from France or from Germany, or you know, it was either a Marvel or something like that. It was always so cool to find those because it was like going into another world. Sometimes, and the Spanish ones, I gotta forget the Spanish ones, you know, sometimes you'd read them and you'd look at them and go like, wow, that's really weird. The repro was usually worse. The colors were usually off-center, but it was kind of interesting to see it in Spanish. And my friend from South Florida told me that one time he went to a U-Totem. You know, we all know about the U-Totem. And he found an Iron Fist comic book that was just made up by whatever Spanish company. It was a completely new story. And the art, he said the art wasn't that great, but it was okay. But it was just like, he looked at it and he goes like, I've never seen this before. I wish he still, I don't know if he has it or not, if he does, it's boxed away somewhere. But every once in a while, you'd get some of that stuff, and that always interested me.
I remember that first convention I went to in 76, they had the guy was selling British marbles.
Oh, yeah.
And I was really, I didn't buy any, but I talked to him, I was looking at them. But the covers are basically, they took the characters, like they silhouetted each character out of some other comic and put them on the cover side by side. And I mean, you see Spider-Man, the Thing, and Captain America, but you can see it was John Buscema and Jack Kirby and, Herb
Yeah.
Trimpey or
Yeah.
something. And but I don't know, they kind of fascinated me. And I saw that they were black and white inside. And but like I said, wow, British Marvels. Well, they were still the American comics, but it was packaged differently. I've seen some Jack Kirby Fantastic Fours from France, and I guess in the 60s they were printing them. But what I liked about them, they were printed two-tone, like
Oh.
black and white with blue, or
Cool.
black and white with orange. But each different chapter or story was one monochrome color, and but. The way they put it
Okay.
together was really beautiful, kind of
That's
like what
neat.
Darwin Cook does on those Hunter comics.
Oh yeah, right.
But I
Two
mean,
tones,
it gave
yeah.
it a neat look. The only problem was the lettering didn't come out as nice as it did in the original
But it
stuff.
was translated, I would
Yeah,
imagine.
it was translated to French, but or even the title copies. You know what happened? They got the license and they didn't hire. They probably just had some production artists kind of crank it out,
Yeah,
but.
with some bad lettering or
They
something or
probably didn't
another.
have time to do it, but I like the look of those.
Yeah, those were always fun because it was like, okay, that's kind of cool. And then the British ones, like you said, I remember getting some just because the interior art was in black and white, because it was the first time you saw like John Buscema's work of John Buscema, say like a Buscema Sinnott story in black and white, hadn't been reprinted here. And it was nice to see your Steranko. Nice to see all the line work and all that stuff. Now with the Essentials, all the work is in black and white and it's available, you know, for reprint. But back then, that was the only place I could remember ever seeing those. And the British comics were like that. The majority of them that I remember were all black and white. I mean, I guess it was cheaper.
Well, it's when you print them a color, it really brings the cost up. And I know British comics are black and white, but so are Japanese.
Manga's black and white. Yeah, that's right.
Most of the
Yeah.
time, sometimes you see one or two pages in color.
The covers obviously are in
Yeah, the
color.
covers are in color. But and I know in Australia, all the like this what was it, the Phantom comics I've seen from Australia, color covers, black and white interior.
That's interesting. I mean, I've seen color ones. I've seen reprints of color ones from India of all places. A comic, old Comic World has some Indian comics, reprints of the Phantom. They're in color, but it could have been, I mean, it's probably they recolored them or something like that.
Well, yeah. I don't know why India, to me, is a very colorful place. The
There
clothes,
you go.
especially what the ladies wear, very colorful.
Yeah.
And
Yeah.
so, and their artwork, the old artwork, it's colorful stuff. So I imagine that's probably what they want,
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But it's funny, I didn't know Australia was black and white too. I know the ones that I got, well, I think I remember the French ones were color.
Yeah,
I think
French
they
ones have
were.
beautiful color.
And I don't know about the Mexican ones, the ones that came from Mexico, their reprints of DC were black, were color, but they weren't good. It wasn't well colored. It was color, but they were just kind of off. But I remember getting a few of them because they were like reprints of older, like Flash or Superman stories, and I was like, oh, okay, that's kind of cool. I'll get that.
Well, you know, I'm sure some of these countries probably have color comics. So
yeah,
I just
they
haven't
do.
Noticed them. I know the British, it was always black and white.
Dan Dare and some of those, I think, might have been in color.
Wow, those, yeah. You know, we were talking about Dragon's Dream last time. I posted Dan Dare on it because Dragon's Dream did three fantastic volumes of Frank Hampson's Dan Dare strips.
Oh, yeah.
Those
yeah.
are staggering. And that was I didn't know what Dan Dare was, except Elton John did that one song.
That's right.
And I thought, what's Dan Dare, Pilot of the Future? What, did he make this up? Kind of find out he didn't, but he was singing to an American audience that didn't had no clue. But,
yeah, yeah.
But boy, I do now. That's some of my favorite stuff. Yeah, those are beautiful. So, in all the Eagle comics, they had a lot of religious stuff in it, you know, and they were always color.
Speaking of religious, you remember, maybe you never saw them, but I did it in the 60s and maybe early 70s, Treasure Chest comics.
No.
Because they were for a Catholic school or something, but they were like comic books about, like, you know, religious or, you know, morality or whatever. But Reed Crandall drew a lot of them, and I picked up a few, not a whole lot, but he did them, I think, in the 60s, and they're beautiful, some of them. Not all, but it was like, and Joe Sinnott worked on them, too. But I remember getting them when I was a kid, a couple of them, anyway, in Catholic school. Back in New York, and I was like, oh, wow, that's kind of neat. They might have been one of the first comic books I ever got. I don't know, but Treasure Chest,
wow.
Yeah.
No, not aware of
you
those.
Never saw those? Okay, those were definitely from the 60s. But, yeah, all those oddball comics from other countries, yeah, they always were a blast to me. The Italian ones, I picked up a couple of Italian ones, like in the 90s, a reprints of, I forgot what the character's name was. It was a Western, and it was in black and white, but it was beautiful artwork. Beautiful, beautiful. And one of them, I think, was even Joe Kubert did one for them. I forgot what the name, we'll post it. I'll find it. But it was like it's not Rio, but it was something like that, you know. And it was just like, you know, they were definitely like, they were back in the 90s when all the, you know, newer styles were coming out, like the Image guys or whatever. They were actually reverting back to the Russ Heaths and Kuberts and, you know, the old stuff. So they were kind of like really into what our comics were, you know, so that was always kind of cool.
I was always surprised to find out that a lot of French cartoonists that work here in the United States grew up looking at John Byrne's X-Men, stuff like that.
Oh, wow.
And they all knew Jack Kirby. You know,
yeah,
they liked
Jack
Kirby. But the French comics, to me, are some of the greatest comics I've ever seen. I love the styles they work in. I love the colors. To me, they kind of treat the stuff as high art. You know, I've always loved those.
Yeah, yeah, they do. They do. The Italians do, too. They treat them a little better. They think of them highlier.
Yeah.
Kind of like they think highly of Jerry Lewis, too.
Well.
But I like Jerry Lewis, so I'm not going to put him down.
Yeah, so does my brother.
And he's still around. Well, your brother played with.
Yeah, I played with him. But my brother, I was always his favorite as a kid growing up. He always loved his movies.
Yeah.
And he just thought, you know, he was... we all liked him when we were kids.
Well, you got to meet him. You got to meet his hero.
Yeah. Well, not a hero, but he did like him quite well.
And he didn't let him down either.
He didn't let him down.
All right. Well, let's take a break now, and we're going to play some music, and we'll be right back.
Everything is algebra, algebra, algebra. Everything is algebra. But life gets in the way. All the world is X and Y. The answer works out every time. But I keep searching for some sign to get to point B from point A. Everything is algebra, algebra, algebra. All of life is algebra, but hearts get in the way. Sorting through the plans I've plotted, every factor in its slot, except the promises that I forgot to keep along the way. Everything is algebra, blue eyes, they speak to me. If algebra really is the key, well then who am I to say? I guess everything's okay. Everything is algebra, algebra, algebra. Everything is algebra, but we get in our own way.
To hear our last 20 episodes, check us out on iTunes, or if you want to hear older shows, you can always find them at our blog, bunchofdorks.com, and click on the Cyclops.
And that was Ed Wattell on his new CD, which I like quite a bit.
From Sunshine Drenchy Records.
Yeah, the label that he and Steve Robinson have. And one thing I found out is everybody that ever listens to the show knows I think Ed Wattell is great. But I hate the man immensely because he's a graphic artist, a quite good one, and he's also a good musician and songwriter. He's had a band back in the 80s called Mad for Electra, which is very popular around here. But, you know, I don't go picking up guitar and writing songs. He don't be designing stuff, you know. Yeah. It's my deal.
But he's too good much of both. A renaissance man for your...
Yeah, and
but
and,
he can't draw, or can he?
I bet he can.
Oh, my God.
I bet he can. Well, the Mad for Electra logo, it had like a dog's head, a cartoon dog's head on it.
Okay.
I'm sure he drew it.
Wow.
But here's the one that gets me the most. We've played Geneva Wallet on our show, who yeah. I like really well. She's on the Sunshine Drenchy sampler. And I'm always asking Steve, I said, when is she going to put that out? And I guess she lives in Gainesville, Florida. And that's all I knew about her. And Steve said, oh, well, we need to. Come to find out, she's Ed's daughter.
Oh. Okay.
What? I didn't know that. Well, it's a joke because his name's, you know, Wattell. But she said, or Steve was telling me that what she complains about is everywhere she goes, I guess Wattell, people don't know how to say it. Sometimes they'll say wallet, you know. Is that wallet? I guess sometimes you write your name out,
yeah, right.
You know.
Yeah, right.
So she just kind of made a joke about it and, you know, started putting it as wallet.
It stuck.
But it's spelled with an O, wallet. But, I think, well, so some of those sounds that I like so much on Geneva Wallet's song we played, that Fake Rain, there's in the background, it's that doom, doom, doom. Well, that's Ed. Ed's coming up with stuff.
Okay.
So I hate him, but I love him all the same.
There you go. It's a love-hate relationship with Ed, but you'll
with
have
respect.
To deal with it, I guess.
But this,
Ed was also in the head. Was Ed in the headlines?
No, he was Mad for Electra.
Okay.
But, they were friends with the Headlights. Okay. They opened for the Headlights before. But this CD by Ed, I like it quite a bit. It's a little more up-tempo and faster. It's got a rhythm to it, which...
You're a rhythm kind of guy.
That's what Steve said when I said, man, this is my favorite Ed Wattell. Man, you go for that rhythm. I have no rhythm, but I love it.
That's why you love it, because, yeah, that too. Anyway... Back to the Fantastic Four, where we left before last
okay.
week.
Okay, well,
this is like a serial.
This is a serial, and I apologize if you're tired of hearing it, but I finally worked my way up to Marvel Masterworks number 5 for the Fantastic Four. And I've talked about this before. When I got it, I thought this would be the one to get, because this has the Galactus trilogy in it, which
on
is...
On the cover.
Yeah, on the cover, which...
For Silver Surfer.
To me is the greatest, you know, comics ever made. But I was disappointed that it started out with Vince Coletta inking. And this is something I've enjoyed reading, the omnibus in these masterworks, was the sequence of inkers. Because I just always assumed that Joe Sinnott inked the Fantastic Four all the time. When I think of Fantastic Four, I think of Joe Sinnott. And I do know that Chick Stone did really nice work in the past because I've seen him. Again, a lot of times I attributed those issues to Joe Sinnott. Come to find out I was wrong. And who was the guy that inked the first issue? Was it
Saul Brodsky?
Was it Saul Brodsky? Yeah.
Saul Brodsky, Dick Ayers.
Was there a guy named
Ink number five?
Was there a Russo?
George Russo, under the name of George Bell. Yeah, him too. Yeah, Kirby had some anchors that were okay, but by the time of Dick Ayers, it got a little better, I think, and then Chick Stone a lot better.
I think Dick Ayers is a really good Kirby inker.
He is.
But like I said, I guess Joe Sinnott inked the third issue.
The Doctor Doom one.
Okay, third or fourth or five. He inked an earlier issue, but then they went to Chick Stone, and Chick Stone became the regular inker.
In the 30s.
Oh, was it the 30s?
Not in the 1930s, but issue 30. I think he went from 31 to 41, and then the annuals.
Really?
I think that's what I read somewhere. The first few were Saul Brodsky, and then Joe Sinnott did one, and then George Bell came in, and then maybe Paul Reinman did one or two, and then Dick Ayers, and then Chick Stone, and then Coletta, and then Sinnott, and then Frank Giacoya, under the name Frankie Ray, did a couple too.
Yeah.
Remember we looked at some of those? He had a lot of people working with
him. I'll tell you, people have complained about Kirby inkers, and I know in the book Kirby by Mark Evanier, he addresses that. And he said Jack never complained about inkers because he looked at it that they had to get work to feed their families, and he didn't want to be the one to stop it. So regardless of what he thought of them, he didn't complain, which a lot of people took umbrage to because, you know, he had some that deserved complaining. But I don't know. Even a bad ink job, Jack Kirby just stands out. But
did you ever try to ink Kirby? And I mean a real one, but I mean a guess. I did once, and it wasn't that difficult. He gives you all the line work. It was just a thing drawing. I remember I did it, and a friend of mine really liked it, and because it looked like, I don't know, Dick Ayers or something like that. And it wasn't really that tough. Later on, maybe it might have been when he gave you looser work, but from the stuff that you see in like the Kirby Collector and all that, it wasn't that. It was all there.
Yeah, it was all there. One thing I noticed, though, with some inkers, when it ink it, it loses the depth. Even if they followed everything he put.
Yeah.
Like, people bring up some inkers. Vince Coletta would erase stuff he did or just put it all in silhouette, which sometimes, Alex Toth.
Sometimes it works.
Yeah, Alex Toth did the same thing. But in Vince Coletta's case, it was all just a cheap thing, a cheap ploy.
But I get a feeling that Vince Coletta was probably told to do a good job on these. I don't think, since this was Marvel's flagship book, or at least this and Spider-Man, I got to feel that he wasn't doing a hack job on it or anything
The last time me and you and Rook and Dallas were all together, I was talking about I was disappointed in the fifth book because Vince Coletta inked the first ones. I didn't know that. But I was saying that they were just so unforgivable. And when you compare it to the Chick Stone work
and the
Joe Sinnott,
yeah.
But, you know, I was reading the last story in Masterworks number 4, and it was Vince Coletta. I thought, well, this isn't so bad. And then looking at this one, the first story in this book, I think is pretty lackluster. You know, it's got the,
I saw the Inhumans in one of those.
Yeah, they come in. It starts out with the Fatal Four? What's that?
Oh, the Frightful Four.
Yeah, the Frightful Four. With Medusa. When Medusa
that was a cool.
But you don't know anything about the Inhumans. You just know Medusa's in it. And, but it's the Frightful Four, and they've come back a couple of times. And, anyway, in the first one in this, you're starting to realize there's a little bit more to Medusa than you thought. And then, but Vince Coletta inked it, and it's pretty lackluster. But then the second and third story that he's inked, it's better. So I don't know what the issue was, but that one issue, that's the one I was talking about. The other ones are okay.
Well, you got to remember that Vince Coletta inked all those issues of Thor and Tales of Asgard, and those were good. I bought them. I liked them.
Well, some of the Tales of Asgard is what I never understood because they look more like how Joe Sinnott would ink. He's using bolder, thick lines. But in the regular Thor book, he used a really thin hairline, you know, on a lot of it. And I didn't like that when I see those. And I've heard people complain that he used a really thin line. And it says, those don't reproduce really bad on the bad newsprint.
Oh.
Well, even on the good paper. And, of course, some people like to... I will admit that it gave it a neat look on some of the fur and like some of the wood carvings they had. It made it look like it was real rustic things. But I don't know, some of it, it doesn't look like they're inked by the same person. The Tales of Asgard stories compared to the regular Thor stories.
I mean, to me, it's like when he was inking the Thors or the Tales of Asgard or, you know, whatever, it gave it a illustrative look to it. Whether or
yeah.
not it worked for everybody, I don't know, but when I was a kid, I thought it was really good. But I think I've said this before, when Vince Coletta would ink somebody that he wasn't compatible with, then it was a disaster.
Yeah, it was a disaster. And some of those guys, you could see he just didn't care, and he was giving little.
Yeah, Vince Coletta inking Howard Chaykin, not good.
Not at all.
Not
That's
good.
That's just horrifying. He did a Micronauts story, and I thought, what is this?
Vince Coletta inking David Mazzucchelli, not really that good either. There were a few others, or Jackson guys.
In the early 70s, there was a Lois Lane story that Vince Coletta inked. And I, as a kid, I remember buying it. God, this is horrifying.
He inked, we're going to have a tough time finding images for this, but he inked, I think, Scheffenberger or Rosenberger, one of those guys for DC back in the days. And I didn't think it was that bad, but... Huh. It depends. It depends on...
Well, he inked Mike Grell on Warlord.
Yeah,
and that was,
yeah, oh yeah.
That one, I was...
He inked him for a while, too, yeah.
Yeah, and what got me was, that's what made Mike Grell great was his inks. You know, his inking was what was nice. And I really, he took that away.
Mike Grell will be at Tampa convention.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, he's going to be one of the guests, too, Mike Grell, so... I don't know. I've never. God, I don't even know if he's still working in comics anymore. He might be. He might be doing something, but I haven't seen his work in ages. I remember the last thing I saw by him was it Green Arrow or a James Bond comic book or.
I know he was doing Green Arrow for DC. Well, for Image, when Image was putting everybody out, he did a book called Shaman's Tears.
Remember that, yeah.
And I remember Pat at Comic World. He was telling me, this is back in the 90s. I was wondering why comic stores were starting to sell toys all of a sudden in the 90s. And he was explaining about, the comics industry was slipping. You know, that's when they had that big bust. And they said a lot of it was Death of Superman because everybody's buying it. And then the internet came out. And people said, look, guys, this isn't worth what you think. They've printed 6 million copies. And people started seeing the real worth and pulling it out.
Well, you know what happened, too? Because I was there, is that people were buying these books, and then they were trying to resell them back to you, and people were saying, no, that's okay, I don't want to buy it. So when you buy something for investment, and you turn around and you can't sell it, even though they were kind of waiting a little bit, they were kind of impatient, then you're kind of like, wait a minute, this isn't a great investment. And that was just not just happening with Death of Superman. It was happening with all the other books. I mean, when I worked at that shop, we would sell, sometimes I'd sell like 40 copies, or no, one, maybe not that many, maybe 20 copies of Aliens vs. Predator number one. Some guy goes, give me 20. And I was like, there you go. Because the owner could get more. And then he'd come back a month later and goes, hey, can I trade you a couple of these for an old comic? Let's say he wanted to trade two of them, which maybe... Remember Comic Values Monthly and all that stuff? The price guides used to come out every month. Do you remember that?
No.
Yeah. There used to be Overstreet and Comic Values Monthly, and then Wizard would come out every month with the prices on the pot books. So if, like, say, Aliens vs. Predator was at $10, the guy would come in a month later with two copies of two out of his 20 and go, hey, I'll give you these two for that Green Lantern, you know, from the 60s. And I'd go, no, I've got enough copies already. And then they finally realized that they got suckered, and that was it for that. Nowadays, though, they're doing, like, goofy things again. Like, they're really pushing the 3D covers, and especially DC. DC's becoming, like, gimmick comics or whatever. They should call themselves GC. But September, they're doing another new storyline, and they're going to, like, I don't know. Pat was talking about it. He's been promoting it a lot. And there's the 3D covers, 2D covers, and blah, 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 and this and that.
Yeah,
and,
you know, I thought those were lenticular covers in past.
Yeah, lenticular, whatever.
Well, that's
you
what I thought,
them.
But he said they're not really lenticular. They're some type of animated GIF or GIF.
Okay.
All
right.
And I said, really? You know, like I said, I don't know. I was wondering how it could be a lenticular design because it didn't have that ripple like the flickering
sound.
Right,
yeah.
And they were flexible and thin. But he said it's some type of animated GIF. But I guess these new covers coming out are more so. I looked it up online. We'll have a link to the blog. But it they had covers of the DC stuff, and what they did, there were animated GIFs on the internet. But it's like Superman, but the image completely changes. And I think the background's moving.
Pat's got some of them on his 21st Century Comics World blog.
Yeah.
Anyway, so yeah. But anyway, let's get back to the Masterworks. Okay, you got to go through 3 issues of Vince Coletta.
Yeah, and I mean, like I said, the first story in here, issue
40-something, 41?
Yeah, it was issue 41. I don't know, to me, the inking is really bad on it. But then the next 2 issues, it picks up.
That's 48, I think. Or is it 41? No, it's 41.
No, it's 41. Okay. But, again, it's not bad. A lot of stuff in there.
It's a great book, though, The Brutal Betrayal of Ben.
Yeah. Yeah, well, because at the end of Masterworks 4, what happens, the Frightful Four, Fearsome Four? What are they? Fatal
Frightful
Four?
Four.
Frightful Four. They basically lured him out to this island off of Manhattan and to fight. And then somehow the Fantastic Four beat him away. But they, they used the Trapster shot some kind of bomb at him, and the radiation took their powers away. So, you know, at the end of it, they're trying to come up with contraptions to, you know, act like their powers. Dr. Doom shows up, takes over the Baxter Building, and Daredevil pops in and helps them, you know, get away. And which, actually, Jack Kirby can make a really nice Daredevil.
Yeah.
I actually really enjoyed it, but they lost their powers, and then finally Reed gets back to his amplifier gun that they used on the Skrull homeworld, you know, when their powers didn't work there. And Ben didn't want to become the Thing again. And he was arguing about it, but Reed says, we need you. We have to have you. So he turned it on all of them. They got their powers back, and he shot Ben Grimm. He became the Thing. And then he was bitter, and he just freaked out and just beat the living tar out of Dr. Doom. And then he was so fed up with Reed, he left the Fantastic Four. The problem I have with this being a man in his 50s was that when you read these stories, Ben's bitter about being the Thing, and he's some kind of freak, and he's ugly. But yet, every time he turns back into Ben Grimm, he's happy for a minute, and then he's sad that he's not special because he's not the Thing, and what's he going to do? Now, as a kid, I never really questioned it. I always felt bad he was the Thing. But as it goes on, I'm like, well, come on, man. You know, when you weren't the Thing, you were like, oh, man, what am I going to do now? I'm not the Thing. Now he's the Thing. He's all bitter and upset.
He's a whiner.
Well, you know, when you're reading each one of these as a single comic book, you know, month after month, it's,
yeah.
When you're reading them all in the chunk, it's, you know, kind of notice. And again, I'm a lot older.
Yeah, there's like the first 41 through 43 and the annual, though. There's a lot of Vince Coletta in this book, about 90 pages. Of
yeah. I never realized that he just stepped in when Chick Stone, you know, stopped. Why did Chick Stone leave?
I don't know. I really don't know. Maybe, I know he ended up... See, I don't know if that book he did for ACG was before or after this. I'm not sure if he drew Nemesis or
yeah.
if he did some other book, but I don't know if I don't know.
Well,
the
I know
timeline.
He worked on Nemesis at one point.
But he did. Chick Stone inked more than the Fantastic Four. He was inking Kirby on a lot of books and covers too around the time.
Yeah.
So maybe I don't know. I read a little bit about Chick Stone like online, and in the 50s, even though he was doing a few comics. I think after the comic book implosion in the 50s where, like, a lot of people, like, quit the business, he ended up doing a lot of advertising work.
Yeah.
But he did do a few like Archie-like comics or whatever. And then in the 60s, he I think that ran out, and he started pounding the pavement, and he went into Marvel, and he saw Kirby's pencils, and he flipped out, and Stan goes, "You want to ink them?" And he's like, "Yeah." So he was like,
"Oh,
really
okay."
Into it. Yeah.
Well, you can tell he's, as I've always said, I know he's, I think, your favorite Kirby inker.
Yeah, I think so.
And he's my second. Chick Stone is just wonderful. Yeah, I'm happy when I see his name on Kirby's. Joe Sennett is my first, but Chick Stone is right up there. What's Chick short for?
Charles.
Oh, is it?
I'm pretty sure it was Charles Stone.
Something. Every time I see Chick, I always think Chicken Stone.
No, but he did a lot of work for, he did a lot of comic book work. I think, yeah, it's something that I wanted to talk about too afterwards, after we get done with this, but about how it seems to me, and it was evident in some of these war books that I got at Pat's for like 20 cents each or whatever. He was getting rid of them cheap. A lot of the guys that we liked, kind of like their careers kind of stalled out in the 80s, like in the mid 80s or maybe mid to late 80s or whatever. But it was just like that was, you know, the last gasps for a lot of cool artists. And I guess they were getting up in the years and they were retirement age at that point, because Kirby had to have been in his, what was he, in his 50s when he did the Fantastic Four?
Yeah, I think he was.
Maybe even older than that. I don't know, but that's when he was peaking, you know. So yeah. I think all those golden age guys kind of like called it the day in the 80s and 90s.
I will say this. I did like them, but I remember when the 80s rolled around, there's always trends. There's always new looks and sounds. And when the 80s rolled around, everything was changing again drastically. And even the music. You know, started getting all those art house bands and the dance
bands
and stuff. Yeah, the synth bands.
That was a big change.
Music completely changed, and it was real visual. And guys I went to high school with were still listening to the music we listened to in the 70s and wouldn't go on. Well, I never stopped loving that kind of music, but I did like all the 80s stuff.
Yeah.
And then I'd get guys, "What are you listening to? This for the kids." Well, I liked it. But then I noticed when the 80s rolled, you know, was passed, I was kind of stuck there as well. Even my wife, at one point, we're listening to the radio and they're playing a lot of 80s songs. Because whatever happened? Why aren't the songs good like this? And I realized it happened to us. And there's always a point where you kind of stop. And I remember when the 80s rolled around, the comic books were looking differently. And a lot of these guys, especially DC, but Marvel had some too, they were still drawing like, I don't know, it was like the older stuff.
But the old style, yeah.
But it wasn't as...
It wasn't as sharp as it was earlier.
It wasn't, you know, they weren't putting as much effort into it. They were just kind of plodding along.
Yeah, I found, I didn't bring it here, but it's up there, a Green Lantern that I'd never realized from 83 or 84, that Tuska. And I was like, wow, George Tuska was still doing comics. And you're right, it wasn't as sharp. But I also get the impression that maybe the newer inkers weren't, like, sympathetic to somebody like George Tuska. Mm-hmm. You know, like somebody maybe like Sennett or even Coletta in a lot of ways might have been a little more understanding. You know, maybe some of these new guys were more... Because back then, they used to pair comic artists with inkers. Nowadays, I don't even know if they even do that anymore. I don't see too many artist-inker combos. So I think it's just the artist and the writer, and that's it. But back then, there was a lot of that going around. It's probably not happening a lot now because the artist just does it on the computer, and, you know, that's the way it is. But back then, they did. And that, to me, made books a lot interesting.
Yeah,
it was when they had combos. And it's funny because I was watching an interview with Rick Leonardi on YouTube, and he was talking about how back then he would send off his work, and it was always really cool to see it getting it back and being inked by somebody like Al Williamson.
Oh, yeah.
Or, that was always cool to me. And nowadays, I just do it all myself, so it's good, but I don't get the excitement. Back then, it was like that, so, you know, but I don't know if, like, the modern inkers were good for him. You know, I mean, maybe like somebody like a Rubenstein or a McLeod might have been good, but maybe other people might not have been, you know, jiving with them, whereas they were more, you know, they were more compatible with a newer artist. I mean, that's a guess. I don't know.
Well, the other problem is, too, it's one thing I always noticed, if the artist owned their work, you know, their own strip and stuff.
Put a lot more work into it.
They put more work into it, and I guess since it was their world, it was their vision. And even if they got older and it wasn't the greatest of work, it was still good. Whereas if you're trying to work in, say, DC or Marvel, or now even like Dark Horse, it's like a whole comic universe, and it's moving forward, and you're not.
But don't you kind of like, in a way, simplify your style the older you, because you get more like, you're not searching anymore. You found it. So what do you do after you find it? You refine it. And what happens when you refine it? It gets a little simpler.
Maybe. Sometimes. Walt Simonson jokes about it. Says everybody's supposed to, you know, get simpler as they get older. It says, unfortunately, I find I get more and more lines.
Oh, there you go.
So he still works the same. I mean, it's progressed and gone on. A friend of mine always joked about George Perez, about how
he still puts a lot of detail.
Yeah, they said a lot of cars. This is back in the 90s when he's saying this, but he says you look at John Byrne, you know, some of these guys that how they worked before and how they work now, it's sometimes even completely different artists. And he says, but you can always tell it's George Perez. Well, he has changed. He draws some differently.
But he draws better.
Yeah, but he always loved him. But yeah, he draws better. But you can see some refinement, some change. You know, I've always seen that progression in him. But he still puts the amount of effort that he always has. You can always see it.
Well, sometimes effort isn't just detail. Sometimes, you know, effort could be not using stock poses.
Yeah.
You know, maybe backgrounds, a different background. You know, a lot of people, you know, back in the day, thought that, oh my God, McFarlane's work, look at all the detail. I go, well, yeah, but maybe that's hiding some bad drawing, you know? I mean, that might not be the best thing. And people think that all the detail equals like all the hard work put in. That's not necessarily true. I mean, refinement sometimes means you've reached the point where you're really good and you got your style down and you can draw really well. And now it's just a matter of like making it, streamlining it and making it look like Roy Crane instead of like, you know, like Roy Crane would be the ultimate in simplicity and streamlined style.
Who I love dearly.
But the thing about a streamlined style is you better be damn good because your flaws will be real evident and you can't hide them with details or...
Well, that's one thing you talk about Roy Crane.
All sorts of shadows or whatever.
How he kept it simple. But he still had detail in it.
He had details. You know? He was a master of like looking. But if you look at it, it's very simple.
Yeah, oh yeah.
I mean, it's not like cluttered art. Let's put it that way.
But there's some artists that start out really detailed. Mobius was one.
George Perez. Very detailed.
And Jaime Hernandez.
Freaking what's his face? He grew to be really detailed. Barry Smith.
Yeah, Barry Smith started getting more and more detailed.
And then he simplified later.
But I know people would complain about it. Again,
Craig Russo was real detailed.
Yeah.
So, I mean, might still be.
Well,
I don't know.
He gets more ornate now.
More
pattern and ornate, but he does get simpler than what he was. But a lot of times I notice this when the artists get older, they start simplifying. But in the ones I just mentioned, they never stop being artistic. They never stop being.
Yeah.
They always had a good look.
Yeah, they had a good look.
And what amazes me about Jaime Hernandez, because I love him dearly. But he got simpler, but he always has almost a single line weight when he inks.
Yeah, he does. I think he uses markers, doesn't he?
Yeah, I guess he does.
Probably, but he's good at it.
But he has a single line weight, but it's something I enjoy. I like inkers. If they work simply, I like the line variation, the weights, you know, how they go through. And so you would think I wouldn't like how Jaime Hernandez inks it, but for him, it just works so beautifully.
He's just a designer.
Yeah, it has a nice design to it.
He's got a design to it. You know, but, like the hair's got a look to it. Everything is like, in his world, everything is perfect.
But it's just like Al said a minute ago. If you're going to work simply, you have to make sure that what you're doing is solid. And
Features are all like right. You know, the figures like, you know, it's balanced. Everything is balanced and everything is coordinated because, you know, people are going to see it and go, huh? You know, even Kirby's stuff got more simplistic as time went on. Even though it was always kind of simplistic, I've seen scans of some of the early Marvel stuff, and it was somewhat tight, depending on the schedule. But it got simpler as it went along because It became like handwriting, I think.
Yeah, I did. It, again, the thing is, when you look at Kirby's pencils, you can see a depth from the stuff in the foreground. And a lot of the times you'd have things that are very busy, like a character's face or several characters' faces looking at you in the foreground. And in the background, you'd have all these machines and people standing around and, you know,
yeah,
just other characters, demons, machinery, whatever. But it always had a 3D look to it, even with
pencil
work.
Yeah, the forced perspective. That was exactly what I was going to say, the perspective, where it's like you see the face and the hands right in front of
right.
you. It always worked. He always made it work. That's the thing about Kirby. He always believed it. And that's the thing about an artist. However cartoony or however abstract you are, if somebody believes it, you're good. You're gold. You can do whatever you want.
But some of the inkers kind of took some of that away. It didn't always survive. You know,
yeah, I know. I know.
Like Frank Giacquoia could always give that to him, to me. I always, and again, Joe Sinnott, to me, was the master of it, where he had those bold, strong lines, and to me, it was almost like a 3D image. And Chick Stone was the other one that just always, and I know Al always cringes when I say this, but when Bruce Barry was on his game, he pulled that out of him, too.
Okay.
He wasn't always consistent, but there were some times where he would, the OMAC stuff he inked, it was right on there.
So, in this masterwork, by issue 44, I guess to the end, which would be 50, you're getting the first Joe Sinnott.
Yeah, and I think Joe Sinnott stayed with him all the time.
He stayed till the end, but I think there was a few issues that he didn't. I think Frank Giacquoia came in towards the end or somewhere
yeah.
along the way.
Well, in between, when Chick Stone left, there was an issue by Frankie Ray.
Frank Giacquoia.
So it was Frankie Giacquoia.
Yeah, Frank Giacquoia, yeah.
And he inked one, and I think there was somebody else that inked one, too. I can't remember his name.
Yeah, I don't remember. Yeah.
But, yeah, Joe Sinnott, you know, it's funny. We always talk about Mr. Media that does the podcast out of here. He interviewed Joe Sinnott. I think that was the first one I listened to.
Wow, that's pretty cool.
And Mr. Media, you know, the guy, he's a writer here, a really good writer. But he grew up reading comic books like the rest of us. And he was talking about Joe Sinnott. And it seems to me, like myself, he thought Joe Sinnott always inked Jack Kirby. And Joe Sinnott said, no, actually, I came in much later, which was the first I knew of that. He said, I inked one issue, which, again, I guess is 4 or 5,
yeah.
which you and I talked about. And I remember seeing that old issue and just assuming that the Chick Stone work was Joe Sinnott's. And then he said, no, he says, I did one issue earlier, and then I came in much later. But he was talking about, he wanted to ink it because as soon as he saw the Fantastic Four, he just loved those characters. It just seemed like a really nice, upbeat guy. You know, I'll have a link to that whenever we mention Joe Sinnott.
There's one inker, he's my favorite, or one of my favorites, of the guys that were known as inkers, that I wish would have inked Kirby's work, and I can't think of anything he ever did, was Tom Palmer. I don't remember Tom Palmer ever inking Kirby's work. I remember inking, obviously, Gene Colan. I remember him inking Neil Adams, George Perez, probably. But I don't remember him ever inking Kirby. I would have liked to have seen that, see what he would have done with that. I don't know if it would have been right for him, because he was more of a realist inker.
Yeah, he was. And sometimes when he inked other people, like when John Byrne did that Silver Surfer special.
I liked it, but yeah.
Yeah, see, I didn't. And I do like Tom Palmer a lot, but I didn't like him.
I liked it, but I saw the pencils. The Xeroxes of the pencils, and they were beautiful.
Yeah, that's... See, that was something. I was really disappointed because I was a huge John Byrne fan at the time. And when I read the book, it was kind of like Neil Adams' Marvel work. Sometimes some of the pages would just get too loose. And I think that was Tom Palmer. I saw John Byrne in 82, and I guess people brought up that Silver Surfer. John Byrne, basically, I guess people were asking why Terry Austin didn't ink it, which is what I was thinking. And then John Byrne said, I was just so tired of seeing Terry. Every time people thought of me, they thought of Terry.
Yep.
And he said, listen, I told Marvel, says, I want another inker. I'll take Vinnie Coletta if I have to. And I thought, yeah. But I don't know. I did see one penciled page from it, and it was really nice, tight John Byrne work. But
yeah, it was nice. So anyway, that's, even though you got 4 issues of Coletta, that's still an amazing.
Oh yeah, and I mean, like
work.
I said, one issue to me, the first one, 41. That's the one I was talking about on an old show. But some of the other issues he did, 40 and the ones after, they're not as bad. It's just comparing it to Chick Stone and Joe Sennett and even the other guys, Frank Giacquoia. It's really subpar.
Right.
But it's nice. It is the world's greatest comic magazine.
And it's Kirby. So it's not going to ruin it. It's still Kirby.
Here's spreading the Fantastic Four love. Company Ice at work. I lent him the Hanna-Barbera Fantastic Four cartoon from 1967. And after he watched one or two episodes, he came, it's so old. It's so clunky. Well, yeah, but it's, you know, it stands up.
Is this Company Ice?
Yeah, Company Ice. And you were asking what he thought, and I told you that. Well, after he watched every one of them, he came and asked me questions about the Skrulls, you know, and stuff. And it was finished. He goes, can you get me a copy of this? Really? He goes, oh, I love this. And I says, yeah, I've never liked the Fantastic. He was always an X-Men guy. I never liked the Fantastic Four. Now I see why you and Al talk all the time. So we got another convert.
Right on. Next time we go to a convention, maybe he can get some Masterworks or some old FFs. All right. Now, what are the mystery comics?
All right. Well, Al has been saying he hasn't been reading any comics. And I was kind of embarrassed because all I talk about is Fantastic Four. But I have read a couple of things I picked up at the shop, but I wouldn't tell Al what they are until now.
Oh, Star Slammers. Are those still reprints?
Yeah, they're all going to be reprints. IDW is printing Walt Simonson Star Slammers.
You mean he's not going to do any new ones at all?
Well, I hope he will, but right now, I don't know.
New covers.
Yeah, and he's got some new interior pages. The Star Slammers, when Walt Simonson, his senior project for school, his thesis, it was a comic, and it was the Star Slammers. Of course, that's not the material that's ever been printed here. But back in 1982, he printed, or maybe it was 83, one of the Marvel graphic novels was Star Slammers. And it was one of my favorite comics I've ever read. And he owned it. It finished. It was, like I said, it was one big graphic novel. IDW is reprinting it, but it's 3 issues is the graphic novel. And he added new covers, and then he added a couple like interior pages to open the book up. One complaint he said about the Marvel one was when they printed it, his inks came out really thick and kind of muddy, which was a look I really liked. You know, the colors I thought was nice, but it looked like it was more drawn with markers. It wasn't as sharp. So the IDW books, they cleaned it up. It came out looking more like the way he drew it. It looks sharp. I mean, I love the old Marvel look, but this one, it is nice. If you haven't gotten them, go get them. Do yourself a favor.
If you can find them.
It's unfortunate. You know, you talk about variation covers. They have subscriber copies, which is one cover, and I guess they have a variant cover for the first issue. I know. Well, the first issue I got, it's the exact cover from the graphic novel, which is a cover that I deeply love. But he redrew a second cover for just the comic book store cover, you know. And I was hoping I could find one at Yancey Street or somewhere, because I'd kind of like to get it just for the cover, which is something I hate, but I liked it. But nevertheless, if they reprint this into another trade, get it. Just, it's greatness. He did the Star Slammers again in, I'm guessing, the mid-90s, when Malibu had that Bravura line, and he did 4 issues with it. And what were 5 issues? And what got me was it had nothing to do with this old series. It's like, I guess it's 400 years later, and it was a different character. Still strong work, you know, but that's coming next. So I guess this is going to be about 7 issues that IDW's putting out. Again, if you have a Red Star Slammers, read it. It's greatness.
Right on. What else you got there?
All right. It's something I'm shocked about.
Nightcrawler, huh?
I like the cover. And I saw it in the store, but it was Nightcrawler. And like I said, the cover really caught me. And then looking through it, I said, this guy is actually drawing pretty well. And so I bought it. I like Nightcrawler really well when Dave Cockrum and John Byrne later drew him. But I never really followed the books much after that. This one has a feel for it, but Chris Claremont wrote it.
Saw that.
And it was a fun story. I guess what blows my mind is that there's so much things happening to the X-Men, I've never followed them. It's like I'm a brand new reader. I didn't know. I guess Nightcrawler was dead, and he just came back.
I don't know.
And they're going back to, you know, if you read the X-Men comics when I did, Nightcrawler was in a circus. He grew up in a circus.
Yeah, I do remember that.
And I guess a lot of people were after him, trying to kill him, thinking he was a demon. But he remembered the circus. Well, in this one, he comes back from the dead. This is the second issue. I didn't see the first issue. But I guess Nightcrawler was dead, but he came back from the underworld. And he's with some other girl that I've never heard of that grew up in a circus with him. They were raised together. And
So this is an origin?
Well, sort of.
Okay.
They tell his origin. They talk about how he was in the circus. They talk about how his, what was it? How the woman raised him. There was a man and woman that took him in. Even the girl that he's with, they wasn't their kid either. But the woman has goat horns or ram horns that raised him. But, you know, in the circus, if you're odd, nobody questions it. But, like I said, the rest of it, I have no clue what's going on. Nevertheless, I still enjoyed the issue. The artist, I think, is fantastic. And so I'm interested to see what Chris Claremont does with it. But it's the swashbuckler Nightcrawler that I always liked. So I'm giving it a thumbs up for it, and I'm going to find the first issue, and I'm going to read the other one.
Groovy.
All right, the third one we've talked about all the time. But
Daredevil.
It's Daredevil number 3 in San Francisco. And I'm really enjoying this. I'll tell you, Dan Slott can write a story. And again, it's following more about that character, the Wraith, the other blind superhero guy that's kind of bad, seems like. And the main nemesis in the story is the Owl, that old Daredevil character, which I never liked. And he just always seemed like a...
Boy, Samney's work is getting more and more cartoony, though.
Yeah, it is changing.
But it's probably like, you know, streamlining, as we talked about before.
Here's another interesting... I do like Chris Samney a lot. But before, I was buying these books because Chris Samney, you know, drew them.
Now you're reading them.
Well, I always read them. And the stories were good. But now, the artwork has taken a back seat to the story. And I'm looking at that issue. If I didn't know who Chris Samney was and I saw that, I probably wouldn't have bought it now for the artwork. Of course, I wouldn't have bought it for the story either, but reading it, I really enjoyed this story. And now it's like, okay, you got me hooked. Saying that, Chris Samney's artwork is really strong.
Now, I find interesting here is that on the credit page, the senior editor is Nick Lowe. I didn't realize that he went and he left the music business and started working for Marvel Comics.
Oh, that's the guy that did Hot Child in the City?
I know. What's so funny about Peace, Love, and Understanding? Yeah, it's on Nick Lowe, and I go, Nick Lowe, really? He's working for Marvel now? Well, they're doing good now. They're getting some interesting people. Yeah, there's somebody there.
Peace, Love, and Understanding, that was Elvis Costello.
He did a lot of work with Costello, yeah, but he did a lot
of... I didn't know he was with Elvis Costello.
He produced Elvis Costello.
He's the guy that did Hot Child in the City, right?
No. That's Nick Gilder.
Oh.
Nick Lowe was like, what's so funny about Peace, Love, and Understanding?
Oh, I didn't know that.
And remember the band Rock Pile, Cruel to Be Kind?
Yeah.
That's Nick Lowe.
Oh, okay. All right, well, that's...
When I just saw that name, I was like, oh, Nick Lowe's working for Marvel now. That's interesting. I didn't know he gave up the music career.
But the story is really good, and the Owl, like I said, was a character I never liked. I always considered him basically a Z-list character. Wow. And this one, the way they did it, it's actually pretty neat. It's a neat story. I like Daredevil in San Francisco. And I just realized that those Gene Colan issues of Daredevil I read were in San Francisco.
Yeah, there was a Golden Gate Bridge, wasn't there?
Well, yeah, because I didn't know reading this that he'd been
in the hundreds at least.
Well, yeah, when he'd been in, they said he'd been in San Francisco before. But that story about the Beast Man or the Minotaur, or whatever I called him, I posted that to the blog and looked, and that was in San Francisco.
Yeah.
Surprisingly, it looks kind of like Manhattan in regular Marvel comics. I guess if you grew up in Oklahoma, one big city is the same as another one.
Damn straight. Not just Oklahoma, either. Well, I got some cheapo books here today, which is something I love doing. Because they're like, you know, these are kind of beat, but they're intact. They're not in pieces. The spine's still there. Cover's missing pieces. But, hell, I got them 5 for a dollar. I'm not going to complain. What it's interesting is that, again, I talked about it earlier, was the artist in the early 80s, late 70s. Well, actually, this one's late 70s. But Pat Boyette, one of my kind of like favorite guys that never became a fan favorite, but I always liked his work. I think people appreciate his work a lot more. But, yeah, I never realized he did any war stories, and he did a few for Charlton. So these are kind of fun. You know, again, simplified but fun. He was better for the horror genre. So that's always pretty cool. But then these unknown soldiers and men of war. Am I missing one here? Oh, mostly it's men of war. It's funny because the first story is usually the main character, unknown soldier or whatever was in the other one, and the art is like, well, look, this one here is Dick Ayers and Jerry Taloc or Taloc or whatever, which is kind of interesting, but it looks like Jerry Taloc or whatever. But the backups were really interesting. I think, is this the one? Okay, no, this one's by somebody whose work I've come to appreciate a lot more. It was Rick Estrada. Towards like later in his career, his artwork kind of became a little bit like Jerry Granadetti kind of.
Yeah,
loose.
Yeah, he did.
But in the 50s, he was doing like stuff that looked like Nick Carty, really nice. I've shown some of the scans on Destination Nightmare, so those are kind of interesting. But I do like the way his style kind of evolved or whatever. But on this one here, yeah, now this one's Jerry Grandinetti, so it's funny to see. Okay, so there's Rick Estrada doing kind of Jerry, and there's Jerry Grandinetti, but it's more of a straightforward Jerry Grandinetti, but it's like really nice. And this has to be, this is mid-80s, so these have to be towards the end of their careers, but it's kind of fun to look at these or whatever. One of these is Chaykin. Let's see if it's this one here. I didn't know he did that many backups or whatever. It's very loose Chaykin, but I like it a lot. It looks very Toth-like or whatever. Let's see if this is the one here. No, this is more Jerry Grandinetti. Really, really nice. This is the one. I'll throw this one at you so you can check it out. I mean, again, the front story is by, I don't know, but the backup, it looks like it's a rush job too. But it's nice, though. I like the feel of it. It's Chaykin, written by Robert Kaniger or whatever, and it's the enemy ace. So it's a lot of fun. I don't even remember.
I have that.
You have those issues?
Yeah, well, Dallas gave me one of those DC Archive hardbacks.
It's on there?
Well, it's the Enemy Ace, and it's got all of Joe Kubert's stories, and it has a Howard Chaykin story.
Maybe it's that one. Yeah. I don't know.
I think it has a Neil Adams story, the one where Enemy Ace met Batman.
Yeah, I do
that was
that
one
that,
in there,
yeah.
too.
There was one Enemy Ace story that I remember where he found a little puppy dog, and during one of his air battles, puppy kind of flew out of the plane.
Yeah.
I remember getting really sad when I wrote that.
That's in there, too. Yeah.
Yeah. But that's like 80s. Yeah. 80s Chaykin. It's like, I like it. It's loose and it's fast and furious and loose and sloppy. But that's how I like this work, more so than the tighter work or whatever.
Now, see, this is, to me, when he was starting to turn into the Howard Chaykin, you know.
Yeah.
But it always looked like he was inking with really thick markers, kind of loose. That's like that Nick Fury.
I think he was doing a lot less penciling and more inking on some of these books.
He was drawing with the ink.
I think
he was drawing loosely with a pencil and
drawing. That's exactly what he was doing. Yeah, which is good.
Well, it had a.
Which is good.
It had a, I guess, sort of Alex Toth feel.
It was
to
very Toth-like feel. That's what I liked about it.
But I mean,
yeah.
You can absolutely see it's Howard Chaykin, but
no, you can see the faces are Howard Chaykin. Some of the. And you can see he did it fast, but it does have that Toth-like feel, and you can tell that there's more inking going on than there is penciling. But, hey, didn't Sergio Aragonés said that you're better off, like, drawing
with
ink?
Well, yeah. I mean, he does do the pencil work, but he does a lot of drawing with the ink.
Yeah.
But I don't know. It does work, Stan Sakai. I think his work just got better and better when he's doing it. But you still respect it. You still, both of those men still lay their work out in pencil, loose pencils, but they do it. You got some artists that, there's times where John Byrne, you could tell that he didn't even do any pencil work. He was just drawing directly with the ink, and sometimes that doesn't always work. You know?
No, that's true too, but drawing in ink, sign of a real man.
Well,
no pencil erasing.
Just, but I think Howard Chaykin was doing some light underdrawing on that
he
stuff.
He was. There was another one that he did around that time called Cody...
It was
Monarch Star Slayer.
Oh, okay.
I think he did it before that, and I used to like Monarch. I like Monarch Star Slayer a lot. It was kind of like another one of those, like, Cody Starbuck, Monarch Star Slayer, yeah, or whatever. He had a lot of those characters, and it's good stuff. So, early 80s, last gasp for a lot of these artists, but Chaykin's still around, still cranking it out.
Oh, yeah. So. He's still doing Satellite Sam. He's
Buck
beautiful.
Buck Rogers.
Yeah, I only got one or two issues of that.
No, I don't even know how many there are there, but, you know, anyway. All right, well, I guess it's a pretty long show, so I think we should...
It's always with us.
It is, but it's always a long show, but a good show, damn it. So that's all I got, man. You got anything, parting shots, parting words?
No, I think that's it for me.
Well, we'll just leave it to the Read More Comics guys to end the show. See ya.
Bye.
To find Al's other podcast, Slow Robot A-Go-Go, or his blog, Destination Nightmare, as well as Dallas' webcomic, The Mighty Blue, check out the sidebar at our blog, bunchofdorks.com,
and click on the Cyclops.